underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester Center, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in Public Health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Richard Russo is one of America's most celebrated fiction writers, as well as an acclaimed screenwriter and memoirist. The New York Times Book Review has called Russo one of the best novelists around. He is the author of 8 novels, including Mohawk, That Old Cape Magic, and Empire Falls, for which he received the 2002 Pulitzer Prize for Fiction. His new novel, Everybody's Fool, is a sequel to his novel, Nobody's Fool, which was made into a 1994 film starring Paul Newman. In Everybody's Fool, Russo revisits the upstate New York setting and characters of that highly praised novel, and it is a great pleasure to welcome Richard Russo back to this week's book show. Thank you very much for being with us. It's always a blast to have you here.
Thank you, Joe. It is a blast indeed for me, too.
I have to say, for those, I know we're on radio, but with the possible exception of Straight Man, which included a duck on the cover, this dog is great on the cover of Everybody's Fool.
I agree. I love it. I loved it the moment I saw it.
It is. It's a dog sort of looking out of the window of a pickup truck.
And it's not just, I mean, it helps to have a dog on the cover of your book, but this dog is an actual character in the book, so it's not just a dog. And I particularly love this little guy because he just looks so optimistic. He's alert and optimistic, and so's the dog in the book. You know?
Perhaps, I don't know how you'll take this, but do you see a lot of optimism in your novels?
I do, actually. I have a running, I don't know if it's a joke or an argument or whatever with my friend Robert Benton, who is, of course, the director of Nobody's Fool. And we've worked on 3 movies together, and we're always looking for something to do together. And when we're working on a project, when we're writing a screenplay together, I will sometimes be trying to pull him back a little bit because he is a man of great faith. He doesn't wear it on his sleeve, but he is a man of genuine faith. And because of that, I think because of that deep and abiding faith, he is also by nature, I think, an optimist. And I always think of myself as much more of a skeptic. So we always have this running joke. I'm always trying to bring him back from optimism. And he always says, Richard, come on, you're every bit as optimistic as I am. And I said, what are you talking about, Benton? And he always cites the end of my novel, Empire Falls, in which Miles Roby has at the beginning of the book this beat up pickup truck. Or no, it's a sedan actually. But in the car it has a faulty glove box and it keeps popping open and it does it all the way through the novel. And at the very end, after Miles and his daughter have retreated after the climactic school shooting, and they've been hiding out on Martha's Vineyard for about 6 months, Max, Miles' father, finds him there and tugs them back into real life. And they get into the car. They're waiting for the ferry. And Miles goes over a little speed bump getting onto the ferry. And, of course, the glove box door pops open. And Max says to him, you mean to tell me you haven't fixed that yet? And Miles says, I don't think it can be. And Max says, and it's the last line of the novel, don't be an idiot. Everything can be fixed. And that's what Benton, sees in my novels that I don't always see myself. I don't always see that optimism. I think what optimism there is very cautious and very hard won. But pessimism doesn't get you anywhere, does it?
No, and I guess I asked the question because it does seem that it's gradual in the sense mm-hmm. you say hard won, but it takes you a while in the novel to get there in the story and in the plotting of the story to say, oh, okay.
Yeah.
And it, which is far from a happy ending, maybe, but at least there is optimism.
I think so. I think so. Even in a book like Bridge of Sighs, which is probably my darkest novel, in that the protagonist begins the book by saying, my wife and I are going to Venice. The problem is he's lying. And, you know, 800 pages later, in the last chapter of the book, Lucy is saying, my wife and I are going to Venice, which looks on the face at face value, would say, well, he hasn't gone anywhere. You've ended the book. He's just been peddling his wheels. But in fact, for him, it's a big thing because this time he's telling the truth. So, again, it's a small thing, but it's not nothing.
Certainly. At what point did you decide that you wanted to go the route of a sequel?
That's all Howard Frank Mosier's fault.
The wonderful Vermont-based novelist.
Yeah. Howard and I have been friends for years. And I think we share an aesthetic, for one thing. But we're forever writing emails to each other. And Howard has a habit of sending me newspaper clippings from the local newspaper, always the crime log, which he knows I appreciate a lot. But whenever Howard and I run into each other, either in Vermont or up in Maine, if he's touring for a book, we get together. And he always says, what's going on with Sully and Rub? As if they were real people, and I would know, you know, which is a tremendous compliment. But I've never had anything to tell him until a few years ago. I heard a story about a man who needed to prune a limb from a tree, and he climbed up into the tree and hauled up a chainsaw after him and sat on the limb that he meant to cut off, sat on it with his back against the trunk of the tree,
great,
pulled up the chainsaw, started it up, and pruned the limb off the tree. And then he lowered the chainsaw back down by the rope, and then he's sitting there, and he realized that with having sawed off the limb, there was nothing to hold on to anymore, to rotate and get down the tree, and he had to sit there for like 2 or 3 hours waiting for his wife to come home and find him there. And I thought to myself, who in the world would do such a thing? And I immediately thought of Rub Squeers from Nobody's Fool. And the next time I saw Howard, he said, "What's up with Rub?" And I told him that story, but I told it to him as if it were Rub Squeers. And I had so much fun, and Howard had so much fun listening to the story that way. That was my entry into this point, my decision to write a sequel.
So the sequel is Everybody's Fool. We return to North Bath, New York, and I'm hoping you can read us the beginning of the novel to just give us a sense.
Sure. Hilldale Cemetery in North Bath was cleaved right down the middle, its hill and dale sections divided by a 2-lane macadam road, originally a colonial cart path. Death was not a thing unknown to the town's first hardy residents, but they seemed to have badly misjudged how much of it there'd be, how much ground would be needed to accommodate those lost to harsh winters, violent encounters with savages, and all manner of illness. Or was it life, their own fecundity, that they had miscalculated? Ironically, it amounted to the same thing. The plot of land set aside on the outskirts of town became crowded, then overcrowded, then chock full, until the dead finally broke containment, spilling across the now paved road into the barren flats and reaching as far as the new highway spur that led to the interstate. Where they'd go next was anybody's guess.
Richard Russo reading from his new novel, Everybody's Fool, published by Knopf. So when you go back to this familiar place, to many of us, fans of Nobody's Fool, you focus not on Sully and Rub solely, but on a minor character, really, mm-hmm. from the first book, Raymer.
Yeah. Yeah. I always love books where you're introduced to a familiar cast of characters, but the emphasis has shifted slightly, and a minor character has suddenly become important, a functionary maybe in an earlier book, and now suddenly he is the main character of the book. I think of Kate Atkinson's two great World War II novels, where the brother in the first book is kind of a minor character, in the second book he's the main character. I like that as a device, and I always feel that, like with the really great writers, that, you know, minor characters, you know, they could be the main character of the novel. And David Copperfield, it's David, but it could have been Mr. Micawber, right?
Sure.
And so with this book, I knew I didn't want to go back to Sully as the main character as much as I loved him, because I had resolved his conflict in the earlier book. And so what I needed was some sort of entry. I figured Sully would, I didn't want him to be much older than 10 years older than in the last book. He was 60 in the earlier book, and now he's going to be 70. I didn't want him to be 85, which he would be in chronological years, given how long I waited to write this sequel. I wanted him to be 70, but something just felt wrong about making him the main character of the book. And I heard, somebody told me a wonderful story about a local cop who had found a garage door remote in his wife's car and immediately leapt to the conclusion that his wife must be having an affair, and was determined by means of the garage door opener, walking up and down the streets of his town, trying to see whose garage door that would open. That put me in mind of Officer Raymer. I thought, what would have become of him in 10 years? And my first thought was, well, he was such an awful cop, he would surely have been fired. And then I thought, no, that's not right at all. He'd be the chief of police.
In reading the novel, I can't get over, as putting myself in your shoes for a moment, of thinking of how fun it is to think of the various conflicts/conversations that Raymer has with people wondering what he's doing with the remote.
Yeah.
What he's doing with the garage door opener.
Yeah. 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 Because the first point at which he uses the garage door opener is in his own neighborhood, and he knows that it's not going to open a door there other than his own. He's just using it as a test case, because his assistant in the police department, Charisse, has told him that your garage door opener could open any number of doors, because it's not an infinite number of signals. Your garage door opener could open. But he thought on his own street, he would just use it as a test case on his own street. And of course, people immediately come out of their houses wanting to know what in the world he's using this garage door opener for. And it becomes one of those comic devices, a MacGuffin or something, throughout the course of the novel. People just continue to wonder what he's doing with this thing. And in the very beginning, he's got it in his pants pocket, and he's kind of unconsciously thinking about it, until there's a little girl across from across the row who sees him with his hand in his pocket, and of course draws another completely erroneous conclusion.
Think something else. Yes. There is a page-turner quality to this. It takes place over 2 days, really.
Thank you. Yeah. Yeah.
So was that new for you to have that kind of clip to it?
I'm trying to think if I have ever done a book. I think That Old Cape Magic might have been closest in terms of fictional time allowed. That does take place on a long weekend, as I recall, where the main character has come on to the Cape with the idea of disposing of both his father's and his mother's ashes, and it takes him a long weekend to do that. The difference there is that is a book about half the size of this one,
right?
And in Nobody's Fool, that book takes place over two long weekends: the first Thanksgiving and the second leading up to the Christmas holiday. But this is the first book that I have written. This book is almost as large as Bridge of Sighs, but Bridge of Sighs took place on two continents over 50 years. So this is 2 days, which means that in fictional time, this book has to percolate right along in order to get all that done.
In order to get all of that done, this is a case for you where it is not meticulously plotted out.
Mm-hmm.
You start, and then you say somewhere two-thirds of the way through, oh, I wonder where this is going to go.
Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty much the same with every single book of mine. I generally know that I have a novel when I've got a character that I know I want to be around for the next 3 or 4 years, because that's how long it's going to take. I know from experience, and who has a problem that in that character's position, I myself wouldn't know how to solve. So that's where I start. I start with a question, not with any answers to it. If I had the answers, I doubt I'd even write the book. So I'm just, I write the books the way I hope you're going to read them, which is to find out what happens next. But of course, there is a day of reckoning. we both can't not know what's going to happen.
Sure.
And so at some point, as I continue to walk through doors and doors shut behind me, narrative doors shut behind me, at some point around two-thirds of the way through the book, I have to have that kind of aha moment where I think to myself, okay, I know what this book is about. I know what happens next. I have a sense of what that conclusion is going to be. And at that point, I've been working in a pretty leisurely fashion, just enjoying myself with these people. Once I get that whiff of the finish line where I figure out what the book is about and how it's going to end, then I begin to work at a very, very different pace. I work myself through to that the conclusion of the first draft, and then I go right back to the beginning and say, okay, everything that doesn't fit that now has to either get cut or reshaped or reconfigured in some way so that it looks to the reader like I knew what I was doing all along. That's my job, is to pretend to a kind of wisdom that I do not in any way possess.
And it allows through that revision process to bring you to that point logically that perhaps you didn't know the first time.
Yes, I start using the front of my brain to catch up to the back of my brain, which has been working all along.
We return in this novel to North Bath, New York, and I find this interesting because in the reviews that I have read of the new novel, I think it's about 50-50 as to a reviewer getting it right of whether it's in New York or Maine. And I think that's interesting because I will ask you the question, mm-hmm. to you, does it matter? This book could have taken place in Maine.
It could have, yeah.
Another way of saying Nobody's Fool could have taken place in Maine.
Sure.
Because they're similar, sure. They're similar towns.
Sure.
But it doesn't. It takes mm-hmm. place in New York, in an area very similar to the one that you grew up in. This novel follows your memoir elsewhere. So I am curious as to that digestion and looking into that place helped in writing this novel in any way.
Has the writing of Elsewhere
yes.
helped? Yeah, I think it really has.
Which was a memoir.
It was a memoir, and of course it had to do with my mother's passing after long years of struggle, and it forced me to come to terms not only with her own death, but with when a parent dies, and of course my father died a decade earlier. The death of a parent forces the writer to consider his own mortality in a way that, I mean, we all know we're going to die, but we do our best not to think about it or to internalize it in any way. But the death of parents forces us to do that, and it changes us. And I discovered that in writing this book, for instance, Sully is still Sully. But he's 10 years older, and he is staring at mortality. He's just been given a diagnosis that gives him a year, a couple of years, but probably only one. And he is faced with his own mortality. And I think it's probably anybody taking, you know, Psych 101 in any college in the United States and reads Elsewhere, and then moves on to read this book and discovers that a long set piece, almost 60 pages long, takes place in a cemetery at the beginning of the book and just lingers there. And we return to that cemetery for a grave-robbing episode halfway through the book. And Bath is becoming famous because that cemetery, because the tree roots are all dying in the cemetery, the ground is giving way, and when it rains, When it rains, caskets are actually moving beneath the surface of the ground so that when you go to visit your parent or grandparent there in the cemetery and you kneel before their stones or stand before their headstones, you have no real great assurance that the person whose grave you're standing before is actually down there or indeed further down the hill.
So even as you're telling that, there's a glee, a glimmer in your eye. That is funny, right? That's one of those things.
I think it's absolutely hilarious.
Yeah. And I assume if it's happening to you and your loved one, maybe not as much, but yet and still there's something funny about it.
Yeah, I do. I think it's hilarious. And I was talking the other day in an interview talking about this very thing. The fact that the people we know and love best leave us alone in the world through their death does not stop the conversation that we have with them. You know, and in that sense, they continue to move. They continue to change.
Sure.
And you continue to change as the result of having these very interesting conversations with people you love who are now deceased. So in a sense, in this Hilldale Cemetery where the dead are on the move down the hillside and where they'll go next, nobody knows. Strikes me as a kind of interesting metaphor for the kind of dislocation that I think to some degree or other we all feel when we visit a loved one in a cemetery. I always have that I always feel kind of silly there because the most obvious thing that I can say about it is that the person is not there.
Right.
I wish they were, but they're not there anymore. So they should, in a sense, we all sense that slip sliding away of the whole thing, and that's why we continue to converse. We continue the conversation with our parents as we do with our children.
I want to talk about the police chief Raymer and the relationship that you write about with his mother, which is really interesting because. Here is a woman who is very concerned about her son because of her childhood, taking things and getting locked up for taking things. Mm-hmm. So Raymer has a teacher who plays a part in this book and an old teacher who is really one of the few people who liked him, maybe, who thought of him in a positive way and would give him a lot of old books. And he had to hide them from his mother because he was afraid that she would find them and think that he stole them.
Right.
That's very specific.
It really is. Yeah. Yeah. Almost everybody in this book, in one way or another, is haunted in some fashion or other by a parent. Raymer is haunted by his mother, who is just convinced he's going to end up being a thief. And Miss Burrell, from Nobody's Fool, who is handing him these books, is really a better mother to him than his own mother is. Rub Squeers, Sully's chum, is haunted throughout the novel by his own father, who is the reason that he had as a boy and now has again as a man, a terrible stammer. He's been incredibly emotionally cruel to Rub when he's a boy, and now. In middle age, that stammer that he had mastered as a boy has come back with a vengeance in adulthood. And you know, even one of the most disturbing villains that I have ever created in a work of fiction of mine, Roy Purdy, in this book, who is a woman batterer. He has a backstory that shows how haunted he is too by a father who has left him. Alone in a restaurant without any money to pay for food that they've both consumed. This book is, chapter to chapter, page to page about hauntings. I think the various ways that we're haunted, mostly by the dead, but sometimes by the living as well, or the recently dead.
Well, the new novel is Everybody's Fool. It is published by Knopf. Rick Russo, it's always a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you so much for sharing with us.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org. And you can listen again to this show or listen to it in a complete unexpurgated form on our website at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.